Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For 4 days in February, the world's highest-ranking Catholics heard testimony from abuse survivors and listened to Pope Francis call for an all-out battle against the scourge of clerical sexual abuse. The gathering was considered a remarkable moment in the history of the church. We're talking about the crisis of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and how some survivors have used art to heal. Coming up, we're going to hear from an art therapist and the leader of a Central Ohio survivor advocacy group. Reporter Heidi Schlumpf has been covering the issue for the National Catholic Reporter. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How much of reporting on the Catholic Church these days is consumed by this issue?
Well, when I joined my newspapers full-time about 2 years ago, I had no idea that I'd be covering it as much as I do. Our newspaper has been on this story since the 1980s, and of course in 2002 we had the Boston Globe bringing it to national prominence. But just this past summer, with the news about former Cardinal McCarrick from Washington, D.C., being accused of sexual harassment and sexual abuse, and then the release of the grand jury report in Pennsylvania, it's been something I've been covering pretty much nonstop since then.
And is there a sense at any point, Heidi, that we're still at the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I mean, it is fair to note that a lot of what's coming out in the, for example, in the grand jury report that was in Pennsylvania this summer, as well as the names that are being released by diocese. I know in Ohio, you just had the Columbus Archdiocese release their names of credibly accused priests last month. A lot of that is, you know, somewhat older news. So the Pennsylvania grand jury report, very disturbing to hear the details. That's over 1,000 victims, 300 priests, but it did cover the whole state, six dioceses over seven decades. And some of that information was from pretty far in the past, doesn't make it any less horrifying. But I do think that we have a lot more accountability now. And since 2002, when the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops did come up with some new rules and policies and procedures for how to handle this, we are seeing a dramatic decrease in the number of incidents.
We're talking about the issue of clerical sex abuse in the Catholic Church this hour, and we're going to be talking about how art is being used to help the victims heal in some cases. My guest right now is National Catholic Reporter Heidi Schlumpf. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I gave a thumbnail of that four-day gathering in February. What was the goal of that event?
So, yeah, it was pretty unprecedented for Pope Francis to bring together the leaders of bishops' conferences around the world. So Cardinal Daniel DiNardo from Texas was the representative for the U.S. there, as well as Cardinal Stupich from Chicago, who was an organizer of the meeting. So that brought together everyone from around the world with this idea to discuss the problem, get everybody on the same page, and especially parts of the world where maybe this hasn't been as big of an issue as it has been here in the U.S. in terms of our response. So I think people were somewhat disappointed at what might have come out of that meeting, since it was sort of a beginning, just a start. But I think it was unprecedented and was at least a start in terms of the Pope trying to respond to this at a global level.
He called for an all-out battle against the scourge of clerical sexual abuse, but the response for many, as you mentioned, some were disappointed. They said it was too vague. There weren't enough details. What is the Pope doing?
Well, he called for a couple things. So he was saying there would be a papal statement about how to handle sexual abuse within Vatican City, and that has already come out. He's setting up a task force to help dioceses where they, you know, maybe have less experience with this, and the creation of a handbook about how to respond. I will say the news this morning out of Washington, D.C. is somewhat positive in that Pope Francis just named Archbishop Wilton Gregory of Atlanta to be the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. And so that's a diocese where McCarrick previously was, mm-hmm. and where the former Cardinal Wuerl was also mentioned in the Pennsylvania grand jury report, mm-hmm. and so not seen as very positive on that. Gregory was the one in 2002 who was kind of the architect of the so-called Dallas Charter that implemented zero tolerance, and he's seen as a positive reformer on this issue. So his being named this morning is being seen by many as a good thing.
Is this like a promotion to go from Atlanta to Washington, D.C.?
Well, you could see it that way. So usually in the past, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. is made a cardinal. So by being named the Archbishop of D.C., he's not automatically made a cardinal,
okay. But
it's likely he will become a cardinal. He would then be the first African-American cardinal in the United States. And also, of course, cardinals do get together and vote on who the next pope is.
So there's different schools of thought about the pope and about the likes of Archbishop Gregory. And that is that, you know, the church is not unified in a lot of the issues that are coming up, not just the sex abuse scandals, but also the issues of LGBTQ issues and that kind of a thing. And Gregory is seen as very close to the likes of Pope Francis. Is everybody concerned about this clerical sex abuse issue as the people who are the victims and their allies in the church?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing this time around that's different than in 2002 is that there is near universal outrage, anger about sex abuse. And to be honest, not just about the abuse, but the cover-up by people in the hierarchy, namely bishops. So back in 2002, there were some, especially on the more conservative side of the spectrum within the church, who said, this is just anti-Catholicism, this is being unfair to the church. Everyone agrees today that abuse is wrong and that the cover-up was horrible. However, we have to be careful because there are people, you know, primarily, again, on the right, who are using this in an ideological war, especially around issues, as you mentioned, about homosexuality. So we see some people using the abuse crisis to say, this is all about homosexuality, whereas people who are more on the other side of the spectrum would see it as an issue of clerical culture and structural issues around power, especially when we're talking about the cover-up.
Exactly. So the reception of the Pope's leadership, there's universal support for how he's managing this issue now or that everybody agrees it is an issue except that group on the right?
No, I would not say there's universal support for the Pope right now. And in fact, that's part of the story is that there are a number of people who see the Pope as complicit and who are using this, in my opinion, as a way to attack the Pope because they disagree with him on some other ideological issues, primarily his, progressivism on some issues. So I think that if we look back at previous popes, though, other popes who were more aligned ideologically with more conservative Catholics were equally, if not more, guilty in terms of some of the cover-up around sex abuse or lack of action on this issue.
The revelations about the abuse of nuns, how does that play into this conversation now?
Yeah, so I think that this is something that has, again, always been there, and we've reported about it in the past. The fact that it's getting attention now, I think, is a good thing and is evidence that abuse is not just about homosexuality. So we have abuse that exists that is happening in a heterosexual way as well.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2002, the bishops and their National Review Board commissioned a report, the John Jay Study, that did find that the abuse was not about homosexuality, that it was more about power, and that the fact that there were an inordinate number of male victims had more to do with who priests had access to, not about their sexual orientation.
I think it was Pope Francis, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, Heidi, but that said that he was talking recently about efforts to screen applicants for the priesthood.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people think looking at our seminaries and how whoever's chosen for the to enter seminary and be a priest, as well as how they're educated and formed, has contributed to the problem in the past and should be how we look at how to move forward in the future. So I think there is quite a bit of very rigorous screening of prospective seminarians these days, both for all kinds of things as well as their psychological issues. It is true that currently the Pope has, Pope Francis, has confirmed previous teachings that said gay men shouldn't enter the seminary, which is not to say that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also issues of how do we educate seminarians? Should they be set apart and go off to seminary where they don't have interaction with everyday people? This kind of stuff contributes to the clerical culture of priests feeling like they're special, above the law, and that the most important thing is to kind of protect the institution rather than do what's right.
Is there a uniform process by which seminarians are screened?
I don't think that it's uniform. So this is part of one of the problems with the church, that while we are hierarchical, there is quite a bit of independence, and each bishop or archbishop has quite a bit of governance over their own diocese, and this would be true of a seminary that's in a diocese as well. So it's not, while the Pope can intervene, it's not like here in the U.S. there's some sort of universal way of dealing with everything. The bishops come together as a conference, and they will be meeting all the U.S. bishops again in early June to address this issue. But there's not that level of the fact that each bishop has quite a bit of control and power in his own diocese has been sort of a governance issue that's gotten in the way, I think, sometimes of addressing this.
Is there any sense about what this is costing the church at this point?
Yeah, so I've tried to do some reporting on this, and certainly I have a lot of stories of people who are frustrated, who are having a difficult time going to church, or who have left the church. That said, and I've talked to a number of people who have decided to stay in the church and say, I'm not going to let the actions of these in leadership get in the way of my spiritual relationship to the church. There is no data yet for me to really confirm this, but I think the place that it's really hurting the church is that even people who are staying are having a hard time donating to the church, especially at the level of something that's like an archdiocesan or diocesan or bishop's appeal. So I think the church already suffering from some financial issues in many areas is going to feel this in its pocketbook.
Heidi Schlumpf, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Heidi Schlumpf is national Catholic reporter. She's been covering the issue of clerical sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. We're going to move on and talk about healing for the victims of this abuse and how art plays a role in that. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the crisis of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And for abuse survivors, healing is part of that battle. And using the arts in healing from sexual abuse has been effective for many. In his one-person autobiographical play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, award-winning poet, playwright, and actor Michael Mack recounts his own journey. Michael performs his play on Saturday at St. Thomas More Newman Center. For more information, you can go to the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Michael Mack joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Ann.
Kirill Zamansky is the Central Ohio leader of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. It's also long for SNAP. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Kirill.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Kirill, can you just give us a sense of how art plays into this healing process in a larger way?
In a larger way.
Yeah, not just through theater, but art in general.
Well, art in general, I think when we're, for example, making hand art or knitting or using that sort of part of our brain that is creative, has the effect of changing actually how our nervous system is working, as well as helping us integrate memories and emotions.
Is it common? Is art and the use of art, the fine arts, however it might be, music, a theater, visual arts, is it? Do you see a lot of that in among members of your community using that to help them heal?
Yes, a lot. From people making music to people doing like improv, group improv, where everyone's sort of rolling around and touching each other, to people who do vocal music. I am a seamstress and I am a designer, and I also teach and carry out all kinds of spinning and weaving and knitting and textile arts.
Michael Mack, you're an award-winning poet, playwright, and actor. I guess I kind of want to ask you sort of the what came first, the chicken or the egg sort of a question. Were you inspired to art by your experiences of abuse, or did art just come up later and you tapped into it?
Well, I was drawn to art through the trauma itself, because what happens with trauma is that when somebody experiences it, they experience too much, too fast. And the way that our psyches try to integrate that, what art gives us is an opportunity to take a mess and to give it order. And for me, that process began with writing and with storytelling. And I'm guessing that Kirill would agree that a survivor's story, a survivor's journey of healing, must involve storytelling or some kind of way to take this trauma and create something new with it.
And right, that creating something new with it, that's the piece. Because for some people, they just want to talk about it. And just talking about it with other people can be a release and effective. But making something new with it, what's important about that?
Well, just speaking from my own experience, when I was a child, what I experienced was profoundly difficult. And I lived with that difficulty for many years, struggled, wrestled, fought with that difficulty for many years. It was not until I stopped fighting and decided to explore it, to go in with an open heart and open mind and try to find a new way of being in relationship with these facts of my life.
Kirill Zamansky, for a lot of people who have been abused by priests or as children and don't reveal that or come to terms with it in any way until they're adults, that's a different kind of a situation. Is that common among the people that you work with?
Sure. Yes, it's very common.
How does it change things? Yeah.
How does it change things? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, trauma affects people differently depending on at what point in their developmental life as a child or a young adult they're abused. And so a lot of people who don't remember their abuse until they're, you know, older are people who were abused often at a point in their developmental life where that was their system's response to it, was to bury it.
Michael Mack, tell us about that. Okay, go ahead.
It changes things in that sometimes you can't report the abuse within the statute of limitations that exists in the legal environment. And so it does change the outcomes of your reporting of abuse. Huh. It changes how you get to deal with your life, because sometimes people don't remember until they're in their 50s. I myself was 30. I'm lucky I had a lot of time to heal. But some people are sort of bewildered in their life about what's dogging them, and they just don't remember until a lot later.
Michael Mack, did you ever forget?
No, I didn't. I know some folks who have, and that is a perfectly valid coping mechanism. I mean, after trauma, the first thing that anyone has to do is to find some way to keep going. And for some people, repressed memory is one way of doing that. I didn't have that as an option. I experienced and re-experienced and re-experienced my abuse in my memory, in my imagination, for years, for decades afterwards. And as a teenager and a young man, I struggled mightily to find some way to handle, first of all, the secrecy. I think the secrecy was almost as bad as the trauma itself. And I kept that secret for many, many years. And it was like a poison pill. It was like swallowing a poison pill, and it just ate me up from the inside out. And it wasn't until I began to stumble into different ways of letting it out, of telling the story, that I began my own personal healing process.
That's Michael Mack. He's an award-winning poet, playwright, and actor. His one-person autobiographical play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, recounts his own journey with sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Also with us, Carol Zamonsky. She's Central Ohio leader of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or it's also called SNAP. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to share your own insights into this issue. We're talking about the power of art in healing from this kind of abuse. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The title of your play is Conversations with My Molester. Talk about why that approach to this conversation. Why with your molester? Why the idea of talking to your molester?
Long before I discovered, decades before I discovered that my abuser was not only still alive but living just a few miles away from me, I had been having conversations with him all my life. I was raised in the Catholic Church in a devout Catholic family, and the church was the center of my life. I wanted to be a priest. I was an altar boy. I was a choir boy. And when I had this first encounter with my abuser priest that changed everything, and there's something I would like to share with you about the healing process, really where this play began. I had no idea then where this ultimately would lead, but I told you a little bit earlier that I kept this secret for a long time. The first time that I ever began to tell this story, I was in my late teens or early 20s. I was in my home with my Aunt May, who was the only other person in the house, and she knew the priest from the little town that we lived in. And as she was passing through the dining room as I was eating breakfast, I don't know what prompted me to say this. Maybe because she was listening to the Today Show. She was a big fan. So maybe there was something on the show there that prompted me to say this. But I said, "You remember that priest back in the town where you used to live?" And she said, "Yeah." And in about three sentences, in about three sentences, I just spilled it all out, and it stopped her in her tracks. And she stood there in the center of the room with her mouth hanging open. And there were two things that happened for me. The first of all was this incredible rush of energy that poured through me. And I felt the power of telling this story. I felt that there was something transformative happening to me right then and there. And the other thing that I saw was how it stopped her in her tracks, that there was a power to this story, not only for me, but also for others. It would be decades before I would conceive of writing a play. But that was my first taste of what the journey of healing could look like.
Have you, you must have heard that same kind of stories about similar revelations, Kirill Zlomansky, because it just, it sounds,
sure,
it makes so much sense.
Yeah, that's why we do peer support groups, because it's really important for people to have a platform to tell their story. And sometimes people tell their story over and over in different ways for years, and then they seem to have processed it enough for now, and I don't see them for a while at the meetings. But yes, it's really important to tell your story. And I also have come to understand that people from communities of people of color or different international ethnic communities that exist in this country, it's very difficult for members of those communities to speak out about abuse that happened to them in either their faith communities or any hierarchy that they travel through. And that using art to tell their story has enough of a sideways come in to the community that sometimes people can manage to tell their stories in that way through poetry or play or dance or other forms, when just straight up making a police report and telling their story has been too difficult for them within the structure of their community, because they really need their community support, and it's very difficult for them to just approach it head on and alienate everyone in their community. It's completely difficult. So this art is also a very important way that people in communities of people of color or immigrant communities can tell their story in a way that allows them to also maintain their community connection.
Hmm. You know, Michael Mack, I'm wondering what it's like to have people, and in telling your story through this play, what it's like to have people come to hear it. So, and you just described that episode with your Aunt May, and she was just walking through the dining room, and the last thing she expected to hear maybe was what you said. People are coming to see you Saturday night to hear what your story is and how that changes it for you. It's not a moment of shock or revelation. It's, they want to know what happened.
The people who come to this play come for personal reasons. You can find entertainment in a lot of other places besides this play, although the intention is that it be an entertaining story. But people that come, come for a personal reason. Maybe it's their own story. Maybe it's the family member. Maybe it's because it's part of their profession. To share this story in community, and afterwards, and at every opportunity after doing this show, there's an audience talk back. I'll be doing the same thing on Saturday. It gives an opportunity for other people, sometimes for the first time ever, to begin to wade into their own story. And I remember one particular case. I was doing the show at a festival. We had a talk back afterwards, and virtually everybody stayed, as is typically the case for the talk back. There was, after 45 minutes or so, we all said goodbye. They left. But there was a young man in his late teens who was lingering as he left. And after everybody else left, he came back. And he told me, when it was just the two of us, his story. And he told me that I was the first guy he ever told. And he, next thing I know, he's sobbing in my arms. And that was an incredible gift that he gave to me. And I hope that I gave a gift to him as well, this invitation to begin to tell his story. And what Carol was saying a little bit earlier about some people telling the story over and over for years, I've been telling this story publicly since 2012. And I'm still discovering nuances and perspectives that I hadn't thought of before. And I think that's part of the healing process, is coming into this new, whole, wholesome relationship with a very difficult experience, with a traumatic event.
Kirill Zamonsky, you said people come and go. Sometimes after they've told their story, they leave. What do you – is something like Michael Mack's play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, something that people go to together, or do they – do you expect members of your group to be going to it? Is it something that you're talking about? And do you talk about these kinds of things afterward?
Whenever an event like this happens in the community, if people bring it up at a SNAP support group meeting, we'll sometimes process it together and express, you know, what the event of it brought up for us. And I expect that what a lot of people who are Catholic who come to the support group meetings might have to say is, well, you know, it was totally re-stimulating to me that this person was going to tell their story in a Catholic space. I could never bring myself into that Catholic space to hear the story. So I never heard the story, but it's re-stimulating to them even just to have something like that happen in a Catholic space and not feel like they can go. I mean, that in itself, even during hearing the story, is difficult for them. It's very re-stimulating to want to try even or hear about something you might want to go to that's in a Catholic space. And you can't bring yourself to go into that space.
Have you?
We don't hold our meetings in churches, right? Because it's too re-stimulating for the members.
You do most of your performances in churches, Michael Mack?
In churches, but also on stages and at festivals. But the Paulist Fathers, which is an order of Catholic priests, Roman Catholic priests, they were the first American order of priests, and they've been very proactive about making this show available to their communities. First time I 2012 is when I premiered the play, and it was that year that the Paulist Fathers in Boston brought me into the church. And it was so successful, they brought me back in 2013, and then again in February during the Vatican Summit. I would like to pick up something that Carol said just a moment ago about re-stimulating.
Yeah.
The reason this play is called Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, is I want people to know right up front what they're walking into. I want there to be no... Yeah.
Nothing cryptic about this, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. No shock involved. And the Journey of Faith part, tell me about that.
Oh, well, if you want to hear the whole story, give me about 90 minutes, which is the length of the play.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I expected through this process for me was to return to the church. I left the church for about 40 years. I explored a lot of different faith traditions, saw beauty in all of them. Through the process of learning that my abuser was alive, reaching out to him, and then this whole crazy series of events that happened afterwards brought me back, well, first of all, to his funeral. Again, completely unexpected, but there I was in a Catholic church for the first time in a long time, and I began to remember what it was about the church that meant so much to me as a child. And really, one of the essential ideas in the church is the idea of mystery. Mystery of life, mystery of death, mystery of suffering, mystery of love. And being back in the church evoked for me again that sense of mystery. And so that was where I began step by step to want to return to the church and to try to work from inside the church to bring greater reform, greater openness, greater truth.
That's Michael Mack. He's an award-winning poet, playwright, and actor. His one-person autobiographical play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, recounts his own journey with sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. You can learn more about that. He's performing this weekend in Columbus. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, it was Kirill Zemanski, a Central Ohio leader of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. Thank you so much for joining us, Kirill. I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you, Kirill.
We will continue our conversation. We're going to bring in an art therapist, psychotherapist, and educator who understands how art does work as a healing agent for people working to recover from sexual abuse. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the crisis of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and how some survivors turn to art for healing. Still with us is award-winning poet, playwright, and actor Michael Mack. He recounts his own experience in his one-person autobiographical play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith. Michael is performing his play this Saturday at St. Thomas More Newman Center. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Daniel Blasi is a New York City-based art therapist, psychotherapist, educator, and artist. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
What do we know about why art has this effect, art in whatever, however it manifests for the creator? Why does it affect us this way?
Well, often we experience trauma before we have language, before we have words. And even if we're at the point of development where we do speak and we have words, it's more of something that we experience more visually. So especially working with art therapy, and I'm a big fan of all the creative arts therapies, but I'm just going to talk about art therapy today. It gives us another language, another way to witness what we experienced and a way to externalize it.
Michael Mack has done so with the written word in poetry, and he's written in his one-person autobiographical play. That's more unusual. That's why we're having him on the show today. It's kind of, the peg for the whole thing. But what's more common? How do people more commonly use art in that healing process?
Right. As an art therapist, I use it primarily two different ways. One is more therapeutically. It's more to document the trauma. And the other is to create a safe space. So when I talk about creating it, documenting the trauma history or expressing the emotions reaction, that's really a way to witness what happens, what happened in the past or is happening in the moment, an opportunity to work through, process what is happening, and then release and move beyond the trauma. And then if it's working to create a safe space, that's literally a lot of people experience trauma, don't have a safe space in their mind or in their life. And it's a way to kind of create that, the holding space when they're having a stressful time or whatever. It's something to go back to and to realize what your body would feel like if it was in a safer place.
When you say a lot of people don't have a safe space in their mind, you mean that that's mm-hmm. that's a dangerous place to go when we're talking about this issue or when they're thinking about these things?
Yeah, because it's like we might have a safe space at home or something like that, but we might not be able to access that in the moment. So it's important that we have a place to go to in the moment. Just think, okay, it's almost like a mini meditation. Like I can think of my safe space. It's not dissociating or leaving your body, but just like thinking of something calming. Oh, that's what my body would feel like in that space. Kind of let me reflect on that for a moment. And that can be like when you're riding on the bus, if you're in a meeting at work, at school, it's just a kind of quick check-in. But it's a more elaborate, like you can draw it or create it three-dimensionally in an art therapy session.
I don't know if you heard Michael Mack a few minutes ago talking about the first time he told somebody about his abuse and this rush of energy that moved through his body, and then also the impact it had on his audience at that time, his Aunt May. But is that a familiar notion? Do you hear people talk about energy rushes, kind of something manifesting almost physically in that way?
What I was talking about was kind of witnessing your own experience. And with art, you do that, you kind of externalize that.
So it's more like and Michael Mack, I always talk about that, just kind of hearing yourself say the words out loud is kind of like your own audience at that point.
That's where it begins. That's where it began for me. And I want to pick up what Daniel said about the safe space, because this process for me began with the writing of poems, of stories, and ultimately of this play. And you would think that being a solo actor on a stage in front of an audience would be like the least safe space in the world to do this. But in fact, it's not, because it began with my writing, with taking the time to really go back over each of the events as I remembered them and to process them safely alone. And from there, to begin to take it out into the world. Because when I'm doing what I'm doing on the stage, I'm doing as a result of something that's taken years to craft and create. When I experienced that trauma as a child, I was not in control. I was a child. But as the writer and as the performer, I am the one who has the power. I am the one who has the control to shape this story in the way that seems truest and makes most sense to me. So I'm taking back control by telling this story. Does that make sense?
Right. Mm-hmm. You're reclaiming your history. You're not letting it, like we talk about having abuse reactive decision making. You're stopping that, and you're not denying that it's part of your history, but incorporating it and taking control of it.
What does abuse reactive behavior look like? What do you mean by that, Daniel Balzi?
When I'm working with adults of sexual abuse, a lot of times they're still making decisions based on the survival strategies that they needed to get through the original trauma. And just like an old T-shirt, your T-shirt when you're a child, you outgrow that. And so now as an adult, you're kind of wearing defense mechanisms and way of coping in the world that don't fit any longer. And it's like, oh, I don't have to use that thought pattern anymore. I can really be conscious of what's happening right now in this moment and make my decisions about life on that stage.
Does that sound familiar, Michael Mack?
Very much so. And the word that I'm keying into is the idea of reclaiming my childhood, of reclaiming my church, which I so loved as a child, reclaiming the entire experience of my life, and to begin to come into a sense of wholeness, not by trying to push away different events of my life, to separate them from me, but ultimately to accept them as part of my life, and to come into a new relationship with them. I would call that, in a way, forgiveness. That there were a lot of things that happened when I was a child that I did, and that my abuser did. Somewhere along the way, I had to forgive everyone and everything. To forgive does not mean to deny culpability, and it does not mean that I am overlooking criminal offenses, but it does mean that I am willing to accept each and every one of these events as part of me, part of my life, and to release them, to free them.
You know, I'm wondering, Daniel Balzi, and of course, Michael Mack, I want you to chime in. The idea that, you know, I don't even know how to ask, but the idea that the abuser is part of this institution that is spiritual, and also just, and particularly, I think, Michael Mack, in your life, because you came from a very devout family, it's not just about that act of being abused and the abuser abusing the victim. It's about a whole institution letting that victim down. Daniel Blousy, does that distinguish these issues of the Catholic Church and the abuse issue from how other people recover from sexual assault and sexual abuse when it's maybe a stranger or maybe an acquaintance, but not an institution?
Right. And sometimes we can compare the institution to the family also. And I really like what Michael said about forgiveness, because forgiveness is not taking on responsibility, but actually giving responsibility back. And with kind of the hard, like, when I think about working with families, in not in the institution, but a lot of times the perpetrator may be the male in the family, and it's actually the mother figure that has a lot of my clients have a lot of anger at the mother figure, the one who didn't protect them. Mm-hmm. And that way would be similar with the institution of the church not protecting them. But at the same time, there might be a very complicated relationship with the perpetrator or the abuser, that they might have brought some very positive things into their life. And so that it's kind of navigating that also. So here we have religion and spirituality that were brought in, but that's where the abuse happened, and kind of balancing. And I really like the way that Michael is reclaiming that and taking that back and what was positive from that experience.
Daniel said that he used the word complicated, and I think that's a perfect word to describe. In this particular case, for me, my relationship with sexuality and spirituality has been complicated for much of my life. And the only situation that I could imagine being more complicated is when it's a family member, because at least with a church, I can leave a church, and I did for 40 years. But with a family member, you're tied by blood to that family member for as long as they or you are alive. So both institutions. Here's the thing that I think that. So the big sexual abuse crisis began with the Catholic Church. Subsequently, we've seen Penn State, we've seen
Michigan State, Ohio State,
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What we're coming to learn, where this is headed, is the ultimate recognition. And any mental health professional or social worker will tell you, where you find child sexual abuse most commonly is in the family. And once it reaches that point, you can't point to an institution like the church or to a college, because we have met the enemy, and the enemy is us. You can't point to the institution of the family and say, blame them, because for us to really own this issue and to handle this issue and to heal from this issue, we have to recognize that it's all around us.
Daniel Blousy, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you as a therapist, if you recommend to some of your patients that they see a performance the likes of Michael Mack's Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith.
I would, if they're at a place where they're able to hear that and witness that. Because even, individual therapy is good, group therapy is good, but in group, then seeing it out in the world and being validated in that way is very important. But just to recognize that they might be triggered, have a plan for afterwards, during, that they can walk out if they need to, mm-hmm. if they want to, which is that they really would take care of themselves around it, and that they choose to go and not be encouraged to go if they're not ready.
Well, Daniel Blousy, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I'm very glad to have been here.
Daniel Blousy is a New York City-based art therapist, psychotherapist, educator, and artist. And Michael Mack, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. I really appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Michael Mack is an award-winning poet, playwright, and actor. His one-person autobiographical play, Conversations with My Molester, A Journey of Faith, recounts his own journey with sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. You can learn more about that, where he's performing it, at on our website at wosu.org/allsides. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.